Welcome to the Social Podcast with your hosts, Melissa Grello, Lainey Louie, and Jess Allen. Today on the show, the crown star Emma Corrin says award shows like the Oscars still aren't inclusive enough. Should acting categories be gender neutral? Then, what would you do if you found out your partner had a secret bank account? And Justin Trudeau becomes the first world leader to appear on RuPaul's Drag Race. Progressive or performative? We discuss. Plus, should you always recycle if you can? And are electric vehicles really better for the environment? We get to the truth of eco-myths with an environmental scientist. It all starts now on The Social Podcast.
Welcome to the show, everybody. Joining us is writer and comedian Adonis Charlie. Welcome to the show.
Thank
you. We're so excited to have you here.
Very excited to be here with all my friends. I'm so glad you can make it.
All right, everybody, let's dive in. So listen, award season is around the corner, but there is ongoing debate about whether big shows like the Oscars should get rid of their gendered acting categories. Ooh, okay. So Emma Corrin, you probably remember, she played Princess Diana in season 4 of The Crown. She and identifies now as non-binary. So they told BBC News that it is very hard being nominated for awards in female categories. So is it time to just ditch this idea of best female actor, best male actor, and throw away gender categories?
Oh, interesting.
Really? Yeah. Do you want to kick this off, Adonis?
Let's kick this.
Oh.
Let me be the one to convince.
Oh, yes, love it.
Okay. First of all, it's already an easy thing to do because we have best director, right? Right? Okay. Do we have a best directress? It's already gender neutral. It's such an easy step to do.
Yes.
And we're not celebrating the gender of the person who's performing. We're celebrating the performance. So what is wrong with having a best performance category? However, I'm a little scamp. I'm a devil's advocate. So let me go against my own self here. The problem with fusing best actor and best actress is a man is never going to win an award again.
Oh my gosh, why do you think?
Because the actresses are eating every
role. I totally agree, but doesn't it make you a little weary to think, like, the last time I checked, patriarchy's still alive and well.
That's true.
So that they did have, like, a best acting category, which I think, I love your point, like, I'm already convinced directing you, bravo. But if they had just a best acting category, would we see women winning, let alone, like, women of color winning,
right?
Because these things still exist. What do you...
If we were judging solely based on quality,
but we,
yes.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean...
But wouldn't that be a nice world if that were the case?
Yeah.
The best actress category is what I watch the Oscars for. Like, that is, like, Kate Blanchett becomes a lesbian, and I'm like, awards, give her awards. One drop of mucus comes out of Viola Davis's nose when she's crying, and I'm like... That's acting. Leo can eat all the fishes he wants, but he'll never win an award from me. Like the best actress category is where some of the finest emotional work is happening.
It sounds like you're saying keep the categories.
Yeah.
Because we might see less mucus.
I see your point. I mean,
right?
I think that inclusion is important, and so. Your first point before you went against yourself was, you know, these are the times. And I get that. These are the times. And yet, in attempting to make something more inclusive, these awards will actually be more exclusive because fewer people are going to win.
That's true.
When you combine two acting categories, actor and actress, into one, it means that every year you're only giving that one trophy. And so to take Emma Corrin, for example, they won the Golden Globe Award and they already took out some heavyweights in the female category. We're talking Laura Linney, Jodie Comer. We're talking Sandra Oh, right? That year, they were up against those actors. But in the same year, if you mean that they would have combined the acting nominees for both male and female, Emma would have been up against Al Pacino, Bob Odenkirk, Jason Bateman, and also Josh O'Connor, also from The Crown.
Yeah.
So Josh won for male. Emma won for female. They don't identify as female. But that means that show would have come only away with one acting award.
Fair.
That the show loses.
That's fair.
I believe in inclusion. I would like people to feel included. I would like Emma to feel included. However, I think if you do it this way, there's another problem that comes up, which is, you know, very few people get awards.
I totally get that. Or you can look at it from the perspective that if there are fewer winners, do we not push the bar higher for what excellence looks like? And I know what you're saying, because now there can only be one winner. Mm-hmm. But then technically, what's going to have to be the bar to actually win those awards? All of a sudden, an Oscar becomes that much more valuable. Mm-hmm. That now means, like, if you win against all the genders, like, what does that actually mean? Like, you are Meryl Streep. You can sit down and call it a career. You are done. Like, in my opinion. However, I just figure, is this already being done? Can we learn from other places? And guess what? It's already being done. Not to toot our own horn here in Canada, the Canadian Screen Awards, they've been gender neutral for a while, and it's working. Yeah. Also, the Grammys have already slowly started to go that way for like a pop vocal performance. They ditched best male pop vocal performance, best female, and now it's just best pop vocal. It's happening.
It's doable.
It's doable. Yeah. And like, are we suffering for it?
We are.
So I don't know.
Well, they're still ignoring people, like The Weeknd.
Well, no, but now hold on a second.
Nothing.
Hold on a second. Yes. It's not perfect. But what I'm saying is, like, we don't have categories that say best male black performer, best white female performer. You know why? Because we've evolved, thank God, as a society. So I feel like this is evolution.
Yeah.
So let's open up the net rather than narrow it. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it remains to be seen. The Oscars are not changing that anytime soon. So we will see what they do in the future. Okay, moving on. According to a piece in the Toronto Star, the three-course dinner party is over. Unfussy entertaining. So will you and your family embrace unfussy entertaining over the holiday season?
I certainly will. I have to ask you a question. Have you guys ever been to invited over to a friend's place for dinner and you were like, oh my God, there's no centerpiece? Or like, I can't believe they didn't iron their tablecloth. I have never thought those things. So I think that's what trips a lot of people up and has almost paralyzed people from having people over for dinner, because they think it has to be perfect. And Amy Sedaris, she's David Sedaris' sister. She wrote the funniest sort of cookbook, hospitality book. You might not want to take all of her advice, but one of her bits of advice is, when you invite someone over for dinner, what you're saying is, hi, I like you. So isn't that like, that's, you don't judge, okay, maybe if there's no toilet paper in the washroom, you might be like, you know, but just put away the bra from the bathroom door handle, check the toilet paper, put in a casserole, and I like you. Come on.
That's
you know?
Fair. Okay. That's fair.
Where do you stand on this?
That's fair.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to agree, because when I host dinner parties, it's like, open bag of chips, paper plates, 500 milliliter bottle of ginger ale, not the 2 liter, it's too expensive. So, but when I'm going over to my friends' places, I want my 9-course menu. I want my. I'm a hypocrite, is what I'm saying. I want, because, okay, I think we need these large traditional dinners because we need events. We need social moments that we aspire towards, right? Like,
can I go one step further?
Absolutely.
So this is going to sound so bougie and privileged.
Loves it.
So I just want to say that, because this is not accessible.
Go on.
To all people. But a lot of my friends, like, what's the point of hosting? It's not only to say I like you, but it's to be able to connect and socialize and, like, strengthen
friendships. And make your friends jealous, yes.
Maybe make your friends jealous.
Yeah.
I have some friends who are able to do both, but you know how they do it? They hire a private chef to do all the work.
Oh my gosh.
I go there and I'm jealous and I'm impressed. But guess what? They're not stuck in the kitchen, but cooking and cooking and cooking. They're with Amy.
Isn't that the most fun part of a dinner party, when people just start arriving and you're sort of maybe around the kitchen counter? People congregate in the kitchen before you even sit down. You'd be doing away with that magic hour.
How you doing? And then you're bringing the chef into the convo.
I like that.
It's happened. Listen, I haven't had this at my house, but I've been to friends' houses, and it's a whole thing. And then nobody private has chef to clean. It's amazing.
Maybe that we should give Simon Russell's a private chef. Yes. I'm not that good of a cook.
I like it. I support it. And you can come over to my place and cook, because I can't make anything alone.
Ginger ale for everybody.
Ginger ale. Everyone gets love a glass. Yeah.
All right, so we're going to take our first break. And afterward, is it ever okay to stash money away from your partner? Ladies, gents, we are diving into a secret bank account debacle when we come back.
You're listening to The Social Podcast on the iHeartRadio Canada Network. Coming up on the show, Justin Trudeau does drag. Canada's drag race, that is. But is he just capitalizing on a good PR opportunity? Plus, the latest royal racism scandal to rock Buckingham Palace. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Social Podcast on the iHeartRadio Canada Network with your hosts, Melissa Grella, Lainey Louie, and Jess Allen. Joining the panel today, writer and comedian Adjonis Charlie. Jess, take it away.
How would you feel if you discovered your partner had a secret bank account? Yeah. A woman wrote to Slate saying she found out her wife receives a significant amount of money every month and keeps it in a private checking account, and she just found out. What would you guys do in this situation?
I have so many questions about this situation because they had been together for 25 years and married for 6. So you've been together with this person for that long, a quarter of a century.
Yeah.
And they get a secret mystery fund, slush fund from somewhere, and you don't know what, you didn't know about it, number one. And number two, you don't know where it's from?
Yeah.
That was huge.
But
it gets
worse.
Yeah.
Because while you've discovered the secret account, you are actually struggling to pay for stuff yourself.
She took stuff out of her retirement funds and her savings to pay off bills and buy medical equipment and stuff like that. And then you find, the advice from the advice columnist was consider getting a divorce.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If you're lying and hiding about something that significant, what else are you hiding and lying about?
There. That's fair.
What do you think, Adjonis?
Do you have a secret banking account?
Of course. But it's a bad thing to have. I am, as we know, a hypocrite. it's dangerous. My question to everybody is, would you want to know? Would you want this to be an open? But the thing is, for me, I want to, it depends on how they're getting the money. If they're getting the money,
illegally.
If they're working at No Frills, making a couple extra bucks, I'm like, okay, you don't need to tell me that. It's fine. But if they're doing tax fraud, don't tell me.
I see what you're saying.
I don't want to be an accomplice.
No, I'm not an accomplice. Just get me a nice Amazon gift card every once in a while.
Oh, my God. But that was part of the problem, was that she was saying she was told when she confronted her partner about it, that the partner was like, I like to have extra money to buy you stuff. To which the wife responded, but you've never bought me anything.
I get that, though,
not wanting to know, because I don't think there would be a satisfying answer. No. Nothing you could say, where is this money coming from? The substantial amount of money come. Think of an answer that you'd be like, oh, okay, sweetie, I get it. Because substantial, And the other thing is, why did you let me take money to pay for things that I couldn't afford and you could have? There's no answer to that.
This brings up money compatibility.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people out there, and especially in our Western society, who feel like money talk is very low classy. That you don't bring it up, you shouldn't ask people about money, you should talk about money. And then what happens is that it becomes so verboten that then these situations occur and you have not started the money compatibility conversation. It needs to happen early.
That's fair. I do think this is fair, and that's a very real thing, but why be in a relationship with someone who you're not naturally willing to spread the wealth with? That's exactly the point.
Listen, you're getting into joint bank account and separate bank account territory.
That's
fair. I am in the territory where my husband and I have total financial transparency in the sense that we only have one account. And
all
what?
My money.
You know this. You've known this for years.
Go on.
Okay. So exactly. You see what her reaction is? Because there are some people who are like, no, separate everything. Divide your money, right? And most of the audience.
Divided.
No.
Here. And
no.
I'm coming from the position where I make more money than my husband. And we have one account. One account. But some people are golf clapping. Others are, this woman is stupid. What a
I'm not
going to
say you're stupid. No,
is what
I'm
you're
not
saying.
No, no,
about me.
No, no, I'm no, not no. saying that. I just want to say for the record. Maybe it's different because my husband Ryan and I have a child. But and maybe that's the difference here. But in our house, we have one joint account and then everything else is separate. And I don't need to know and want to know anything as long as everybody's putting into that fund in the middle to take care of all the expenses. Okay. Right? And that, so I don't, because to me, that, what happens in this story is that if you are hiding all that money and you never told me, hey, you're not buying me anything, so there's nothing in it for me, that tells me you're either having an affair or you are a squirrel hoarding your nuts so that you can, so that, but why? Like that. So that you can bail from me at any minute. That's what it's dangerous. You're okay.
I better be okay because, like I said, I have one account.
Let's leave you with the last word. What were we going
to
say?
My last word to add is I completely agree, but sometimes, not necessarily in this situation, but sometimes it is necessary and helpful to have secrets in a relationship. I will say.
I will.
Listen, when you are 11 seasons deep into a relationship, okay, you need a season finale. You need a reveal to have spice back into your life. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a secret account with millions of dollars you're making on the side. But sometimes you need to drop a surprise. I have a half brother and he's alive. And he's here tonight.
I get it.
Just to keep things interesting.
Okay, I get it.
It's nice to have a relationship evolve. And sometimes things that you just
surprise.
Didn't mention beforehand.
Sure.
Come up and
just buy me a nice pair of shoes and
a little spicy.
I love that you compare your relationship to a season of television or seasons of television.
Sometimes you're binging, sometimes you're not.
We're gonna wrap up with the last topic because I think it's a goodie. I don't know if you guys are fans of Canada's Drag Race, Canada versus the World. Well, if you were watching last Friday, you know that our prime minister became the first world leader to appear on any of RuPaul's Drag Race iterations. Not everybody's a fan.
Love that.
In this pre-taped appearance of Canada's Drag Race, Canada versus the World, Justin Trudeau shared his thoughts on embracing diversity and said there's still a lot of work to do toward building allyship in our country, but of course said we want to be inclusive here. So clearly the audience is not unanimous. Mm-hmm. What did we think of this?
Thank you.
What did we
He's
think
a
of
divisive
this?
Character. Yeah.
Yes. Jonas?
I actually am incredibly disappointed in Trudeau. For what? Thank you. For having the audacity to walk onto that stage without his beard. Because I had become accustomed to Daddy Trudeau, Daddy Doe as I call him, with that salt and pepper beard. It is homophobic for him, the daddiest prime minister, to walk out naked on the face. I'm just gonna say that's strike one for me. Thank you.
That is not where I thought you were going with that at all. That was your biggest issue.
Everything else is great.
Messaging was good. Yeah.
No, the way I really feel like it's certainly virtue signaling. It's performative, but on one hand, you go on RuPaul to perform.
But
is this what the gays really need right now? Because I don't know about you, but I need dental. Okay.
Yeah.
I need housing. Like there are some priorities that I feel like haven't been met since he stepped into office.
Absolutely fair commentary. I am still recovering from the beard.
Daddy-o?
But here's
Daddy
the question.
Daddy-do.
When you said, is this what the gays need right now? That's a very fair question. Mm. But my question is, because he is the very first world leader of all ever to appear on any of the drag races, and we know there are so many iterations, even if you think it's virtue signaling or performative,
isn't that still a powerful statement for any country to make?
Yeah.
And I say this because, as we know, the World Cup is happening right now. You know what's happening? You won't applaud this next part, but Qatar has criminalized homosexuality. Mm-hmm. So when you, if you juxtapose the fact that he didn't just appear on any Drag Race, he appeared on Canada versus the World. There are international queens there from the US, from the UK, from New Zealand, from Canada. I thought it was a bold move because it wasn't just like, this is great for Canada. It was to tell the world, hey, it's a call to action for other world leaders to be like, what are you doing to support your gays?
And not only that, he acknowledged that there is still so much work to do. And I like that. He didn't come on just sort of tapping himself on the shoulder. And Canada, he did applaud Canada to be said, but there's still so much more that we can do, which I like.
Yeah. That is a very good point.
Okay, you want to have the last word?
I would say. I think part of it, though, is that part of the reason why he's the first person, the first sovereign to make it onto the show is, do we really even want to see King Charles walk onto that stage?
Does he belong?
He kind of does have a natural. I would love to see him compete on RuPaul as well. That would be the sign of solidarity.
Who would be the first world leader to do that?
Would be, and that would be very impressive. But I do think this is a good point. And this is a time where we need to gather around the queer community because it's been hard recently.
Yeah.
And this is the perfect opportunity, you're right, for him to make that message. So I do completely agree with that
so
point.
So put your wig on, Daddy Doe.
Yeah.
Jonas, you have been amazing. Period.
Thank you. Oh my gosh.
This has been a ton of fun. Thank you for gracing us with your presence.
It's a pleasure.
Still to come on the show, the latest racism scandal to rock the royal family, what Prince William's godmother said to a black British charity boss, and what it says about the firm. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Social Podcast on the iHeartRadio Canada Network. Download the show wherever you find your favorite podcasts. And make sure to catch The Social weekdays at 1 p.m. on CTV. Your hosts, Melissa Grello, Lainey Louie, and Jess Allen are back now. Plus, musician and activist Rolly Pemberton, a.k.a. Cadence Weapon, joins the panel. Take it away, Mel.
Okay, a Buckingham Palace aide has apologized and now resigned after she repeatedly asked a black British charity boss where she was from. So Ngozi Fulani posted the details on Twitter saying that while attending a party at Buckingham Palace, the aide had moved aside Ngozi's hair to reveal her name badge. And then she was questioned multiple times over where, quote, her people came from, despite having said many times that she was a British national. Okay, we're going to dive straight into this story because it is everywhere, and it seems that the royals can't escape this kind of scandal. Have they learned nothing at all? Where shall we begin, Lainey?
I think we need to begin what you just said. I mean, they have learned nothing at all. If you dive into the history books, you don't even have to go that far back. John Oliver did a whole thing on it on Last Week Tonight. These people are the OG colonizers. Mm-hmm. They have a very bad history with, you know, people of color. So for a representative of the royal family at Buckingham Palace, an official event, this woman, her name is Lady Susan Hussey. And she apparently was a favorite of the queen, the late Queen Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. She is the godmother of Prince William. So she wields a certain amount of influence and power. She's embedded deep in those royal halls. For her to do this at an official event, imagine what she does behind closed doors and what she says. And imagine what she says to family members. And I'm talking about a certain family member, two family members who left the royal family and accused the royal family of internal racism, which everybody up and down denied and didn't do anything about, which has a direct connection to Ngozi's story. Because you know why? If they had listened and learned, maybe another black woman wouldn't have had to be traumatized at the palace yesterday.
Wow. Nicely said.
Rolly, you want to dive in?
Yeah, you know, the royal family, they're not quite known for their race relations.
You don't say.
Yeah, it's not really their vibe. But yeah, I honestly can relate to the situation. I feel like so many places, so many situations where, you know, whether it's on the road or even, you know, in my neighborhood, you know, people are suspicious for some reason of, you know, where are you supposed to be here? Where are you from? Where are you really from? Where are your people from? I'll be like, I'm from Edmonton.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's the only answer for
me. What is your response? Because Ngozi kept saying, I'm from here. Yeah. What is your response?
Well, I'm like, yeah, no, I'm from here. Like, I live here, you know. But I think really the purpose of someone asking you that is really destabilize you, you know. And it's to make you, to be like, I think you don't belong here. Mm-hmm.
Rolly, I'm so glad you're talking, and I'm not looking for an education session right here for the lone white person on the panel. But there are times like that you feel like it's destabilizing. I will never ask a person of color where they're from because of that reason, because I don't want it to be perceived as a microaggression or to destabilize them. But I will admit, there are times where I really am curious and hope it sort of comes out naturally to find out if we have shared experiences, to find out where their family comes from, to find out more about them. And it feels like it's from a very good, genuine place, yet I never do it. So this is the education part. Is there ever a time to do it? Like, is there ever a time where you were like, if we were backstage and we're talking and it came up, like, I don't know.
Yeah, is for there sure. For sure, yeah. It's context is really important.
Context.
It's all about the context, right? Like, say, I have you over for a dinner party or something, and we're just talking, and which, like, we could do.
Oh my God, I love it.
You know, it's important, you know, the context. But I would never be like, you know, it's like, so where are you really from? You know, what's your ethnicity? Swedish or something? Like, I feel like it's only something that really happens to people of color.
Right, right.
It is, okay. Yeah. And it's funny because we brought this up before because back in the day when, you know, pre-COVID, we would have meet and greets in the audience. And because I'm a mixed race person, I'm Asian and I'm European, I spot other mixed people very quickly. And many times I say, what's your mix? Mm-hmm. And very naturally there's an exchange. But I don't know that just anybody can walk up to somebody who is mixed and be like, what's your mix?
Because I think you could be perceived. That and I'm always thrilled by it because usually it's backstage, I'm with you. And in my head, it's like, I would love to ask, but I don't think I should. But you do it and then I find out and it's beautiful.
Yeah, and I think the reason is also, again, context matters because then it's an opportunity to share stories in this case. And I think that context absolutely does matter. And particularly if it's in a shared environment, like an intention matters. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This intention behind this, if I can share a little bit of the exchange. So Lady Susan Hussey, after asking many times, like, where are you from? And the answer was like, I'm from Hackney and I'm British. And like for many times that this woman said she's from, said, no, what part of Africa are you from?
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. They didn't leave any records. Lady Hussey, well, you must know where you're from. I spent time in France. Where are you from? Here in the UK. No, but what nationality are you? I am born here and am British. No, but where do you really come from? Where do your people come from?
That puts it into context.
My people, lady, what is this? Oh, I can see I'm going to have a challenge getting you to say where you're from. When did you first come here? Lady, I am a British national. My parents came here in the 50s when, oh, now I get it. In the end, you're Caribbean. Now, so this exchange, so the intent matters. Yes. The intent was, I'm going to make you understand you are not from here and I don't see you
as from
here.
And I'm going to be right. Here. The outcome
and
is that I'm going to be right. Right.
You would never do that, Jess.
And, oh, thank God. Yeah. And
you would never.
Lady Hussey also moved the woman's hair so that she could read, like, touched her hair. Lady Hussey is no lady. We're moving on. We're going to move on to a freaky topic. Did you know you can deep fake your own voice? So Wired has a story about a musician who created an AI-powered vocal clone that can speak in her own voice and even speak in different languages. So, Rolly, as a musician, what's your take on this?
Well, I'm familiar with the artist Holly Herndon, and you know, she's a really groundbreaking kind of futuristic musician herself. So I think she's coming from a creative perspective, but it is a little creepy. Like, I think the whole AI thing, you know, please don't turn me into a hologram. Whatever you do,
you heard it here.
I don't want to do it.
No, I understand what, like, why people are creeped out, because there are some people who say that this technology can be used to, like, say, for example, someone wakes up one day and says, oh, I want to do a duet with Michael Jackson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then they can, you know, create Michael Jackson's voice, but Michael Jackson, of course, isn't really singing. And that is weird, right? Like, I don't know. Like, that would make me feel icky.
There is a plus here, Lainey. I don't know if you've overlooked the obvious, but Lainey and I fancy ourselves really good karaoke.
Correct.
Artists.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm.
That is,
okay.
Yeah, those are
facts. People on our staff don't seem to agree with us.
That is not facts.
But that's just...
I see you clapping, and I don't know why people
who
work with us.
Yeah, I don't know, because, you know, I don't think we're that bad, but their only upside I could see to this is that if you were to deep fake our voices, we could sound to others the way we sound to ourselves. And it could be a win-win.
A great solution.
I meant for the accents. You could train yourself to actually do them really, really well.
What are you saying? What are you saying?
No. No. We're not going to go there.
You know, I will say, I love that you talked about Holly Herndon, right?
Yeah.
And how, like, she's an artist. Mm-hmm. And so this is a creative pursuit. Mm-hmm. And I think about auto-tune and how I know that a lot of people knock auto-tune and what it's used for and what it's overused for. But, like, one of the artists most closely associated with auto-tune is T-Pain. Mm-hmm. And T-Pain's singing voice without auto-tune is incredible.
He's a great singer.
But he chooses to use auto-tune on his records because it's an artistic, creative choice. So I feel like if you do something like this responsibly and you're not being creepy and you do it as a creative tweak on something, it could work. I don't know how. I'm not an artist. But it made me think about autotune that way. What do you think?
No, that's a good point. I think the intention is really important. I think Holly Herndon, in her situation, she is doing it of herself.
Yeah.
Right? It's not some label being like, we're doing the Holly hologram. Like, like, it's not this, like, extractive process. You know, I think I'm cool with it as long as I'm doing it.
Good point.
Up next on The Social Podcast, should you recycle everything you can? And is a real Christmas tree really better for the environment than a fake one? Scientist Calvin Lacken puts our knowledge to the test with some eco-myth busting. Don't miss it. Next week on The Social, we're getting serious about learning pickleball. And one of the world's top champions, Catherine Parenteau, will be stopping by. And stylist Erica Warwick shows us how to wear velvet for the holidays. Plus, creative cocktails and festive vegan meal ideas. The Social, weekdays at 1 p.m. on CTV.
Welcome back to the show. So listen, when it comes to going green, there's so much conflicting information out there. Stuff can get really confusing fast. That is why we love when our next guest is here, because he lays everything out for us in a nuanced yet understandable way.
Well, it's my favorite. Yeah. He's a research scientist at York University's Faculty of Environmental Studies, and he's here to break down fact from fiction. Calvin Lacken, welcome back!
So we're going to go through a series of statements about going green. We're all going to guess if the statement is fact or flawed with our paddles, and then you're going to set us straight. Does that sound reasonable?
Sounds good to me.
Okay, so let's dive in. The first statement is, if you can recycle something, you should. So is this, audience, everyone, is this logic fact or flawed?
I feel like it's a trick question.
I think it's trick too.
Can you reuse it first?
It's flawed.
Yes!
So just because you can recycle something doesn't mean that you should. There's a fundamental difference between recycling and recyclability. Almost anything can be recycled if you throw enough time and money at it. So it might seem like a cool idea to turn shampoo bottles into running shoes or chip bags into totes. But the reality is you're spending an enormous amount of money to make a product that will still be landfilled in the end.
Oh.
Recyclability, on the other hand, is a much more nuanced topic because it looks at things like economic tenability, social impact, environmental impact. And so not all recycling is created equal.
Oh.
Okay, so if we're putting putting too much emphasis on recycling in addition to what you said about recyclability? Like, what should we focus on instead? Or is it learning more about recyclability?
Mm-hmm. So I think actually the key is here is there's a very catchy phrase, reduce, reuse, recycle. Mm-hmm. But that's not just a catchy phrase. It's the order in which we're supposed to do things.
Okay.
Our goal should be to reduce first, reuse second,
yes,
and recycle as a last resort.
I see. Huh? Well, that makes sense. I
right?
Get that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what? That's good.
You know what?
Recycling is often, I think that in the order
yes.
of things, I think we go recycle probably before reduce and
reuse. And somebody, yeah, yeah. I don't know what world leader said this, somebody said Canadians are addicted to recycling.
That is very mm-hmm. true.
And they didn't say it in a nice way. Okay, I love that. Okay. Okay, next question. This one I'm so excited about because I'm car hunting right now. Electric cars, are they better for the environment? Is this a fact or is it flawed?
Flawed.
Is everyone
flawed?
Knew
yeah.
that?
Everybody?
I'm just, what do we feel? There's
pressure.
A few. There's a few.
Yeah. So flawed, yeah. So I want to preface this by saying the transition to EVs is absolutely necessary in the fight against climate change. But just because you have an EV vehicle doesn't necessarily mean it's better for the environment. Manufacturing an EV car requires significantly more resources than a petrol-based car. So therefore, you'd have to drive it thousands of kilometers before you actually get a net environmental benefit. There's also a secondary issue is that end-of-life batteries used in EVs are very toxic, very dangerous, and very difficult to manage. So it's an additional consideration that you don't normally have to think of when it comes to a petrol-based car.
Okay, wow. Can I also add in one more question?
Sure.
What mining does to the earth to get
yeah.
the minerals for that battery in the
yep.
first place?
Yeah.
The footprint is enormous. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wildlife too. Also, so let's say someone is still considering buying an electric car. What should they consider before doing it?
So I think the most important thing is, well, there's two criteria. So there's fuel efficiency and charge range.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, so for petrol-based cars, fuel efficiency refers to miles per gallon. How mm-hmm. far can you get on 1 gallon of gas? And charge range for an electric vehicle says, how far can I drive it before I need to recharge it?
Right.
The longer the charge range, the smaller your environmental footprint.
Oh, okay. So look for a long charge battery.
Okay, got it.
Okay,
got it. Great.
Okay, so this is next. This is the statement. Natural products are always preferred over synthetic products. Is this logic fact or flawed?
I'm going to say flawed.
So it is flawed.
I don't know. Okay.
It is flawed.
Yeah. So this is one of the most confusing things for consumers because when we think of the word synthetic, we often conjure up images of laboratories and chemicals, and we assume that natural is better. But we shouldn't ascribe value statements to these terms. You can have instances where synthetic is better than natural, and natural is better than synthetic. There's also a secondary issue that what constitutes natural is very ill-defined. You have thousands of products that kind of use that language where they say organic or sustainably sourced, when in reality, there is no common definition or metrics. There's a lot of confusion for consumers. So once again, synthetic doesn't mean bad and natural doesn't mean good.
Love that.
Okay.
Love that.
All right. Here's our next statement. Guys, my head's spinning already. It's one a lot of us will be considering as we head into the holidays. So it's a big one. And I've debated this in my family for years. Natural Christmas trees are actually better for the environment than artificial trees. Fact or flawed?
Fact.
Flawed.
Flawed. Oh, no, fact. That's what I meant. Natural, like, is a real tree.
Hopefully, because I have a fake one.
So natural trees are what's best for the environment. So that's
so
a fact.
Yeah.
So
for real? Really?
Yeah.
So okay, go please.
So even though a synthetic tree can be used multiple times, there's a couple of considerations.
Yeah.
One, it also requires significantly more resources when compared to a natural tree. And also, it's traveling thousands of kilometers to reach our home. Most of these trees are manufactured in Asia. The second issue is that you'd have to use it between 10 and 15 years before you start to see an environmental return.
Okay.
And generally speaking, people don't hold on to synthetic trees that long.
And I also heard that the time that a natural tree is actually in existence from when it's planted and it grows, it's actually doing the earth good by using carbon dioxide.
Absolutely, yeah.
But my synthetic another tree never did it.
Okay, but what about, I used to do a natural tree and we would put it to the curb and the idea was that the city takes it and does something really wonderful with it. Is that what we should be doing?
So it depends on the city. So some some communities do offer special curbside pickups for end-of-life trees. They'll take it and they'll mulch it or they'll compost it. However, that tends to only be for single family homes in urban areas with curbside collection. In other communities, you can actually try to break down the natural tree yourself, bundle it up, and include it as part of your city's yard waste program.
Oh, that's a good idea. That's very
good.
That's
a great, yeah,
that's a
great
tip.
See, and we told you that Calvin brings the knowledge, right?
Yes, Calvin, absolutely the best. You always teach us so much when you're here. Thanks for stopping by. We love you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to The Social Podcast on the iHeartRadio Canada Network. The conversation continues on The Social. That's weekdays at 1 p.m. on CTV. Join us.
Don't miss a fiery debate. Subscribe to The Social Podcast on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your favorite shows. Until next time, socialites.